Inside the Boss Podcast.
Thanks for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, and I am joined again by Matt Kinnear and Christian Sweezy as we are recapping the 2013 fall ball season around Division I. If you missed it, check out Part 1, where we cover the ACC, the new programs, and a couple of themes of fall ball, generally speaking. And to bring you up to speed on the format, we are talking to these two fine, esteemed colleagues, gentlemen, and writers, because Christian has spoken with the top 20 coaches and a handful others in preparing the top 20 teams write-ups for the 2014 Face-Off yearbook. He also attended a handful of practices and other fall ball events. Matt Kinnear is the online manager at Inside Lacrosse, and he headed up the very aggressive fall ball all-access feature, which I believe spotlighted, was it 17 programs, and you wrote 9 of them, if my counting is correct. Whereas I was totally detached from this fall ball lacrosse season and feel like I need to get educated. So this podcast exercise, which I hope that you enjoy over the coming days, weeks, and months, is as much for me as it is for you. So let's dive right in. This time through, we're going to talk about the Big East and the future Big Ten, just to kind of do a little bit of a catch-all of teams that are both in the top 20 and teams that we saw. We're going to start with the Denver Pioneers, the newest edition of the Big East. They will play as a member of the Big East in 2014 after having spent the last handful of seasons competing for the ECAC championship. Coach Bill Tierney's team says goodbye to a handful of seniors that were very instrumental in moving that program forward. Chase Carrero, Cameron Flint, a handful of other guys. Eric Law, who was a sophomore transfer that emerged as their third attackman for two seasons before, being, in my opinion, a bona fide Tewarton candidate at the X-Attack after taking over for Alex Demopoulos when he left, graduated alongside Mark Matthews. So, but that being said, the cupboard is far from bare for the Pios. And, you know, one of the themes for them this fall ball was injuries. And it kind of is when I think you have a Canadian identity. Those guys play so much over the summer that they're going to come in nicked up at best and with a serious injury at worst. And that was what Wesley Berg was dealing with, as he had a broken foot in his junior A loop. Jeremy Noble, who struggled with a handful of injuries last season, I believe was mostly a hamstring, right, that he just couldn't shake. He had some injury issues that he was dealing with in the fall as well, as did Sean Canizzaro, Eric Adamson, two of their midi-slash-attackmen. Adamson especially emerged as their late-game scoring threat. He had the game-tying goal in the quarterfinals, maybe the game-winner.
I thought, against Carolina.
Yeah, so that was a familiar role for him after having done that a couple of times over the course of the season. So, yeah, I mean, that injury bug, but, you know, they bring back a fair amount offensively. And talking with Coach T in the fall, he mentioned how well, keep in mind that they have their two-goalie system with Jamie Foss and Ryan LaPlante. He mentioned how well Foss had been playing as a senior. Really kind of seemed like he was trying to take the bull by the horns. Then an interesting and aggressive fall ball approach. They scrimmaged the Canadian national team. And then I believe at Canisius, when the Canadian national team was playing their kind of back-to-back situation with them, Robert Morris and Canisius as well. And then they scrimmaged the Denver Outlaws, or some formation of the Denver Outlaws, in terms of who was available to play that weekend. And a lot of young guys coming up. Zach Miller being a top-rated freshman that T was very happy with, but certainly didn't give me the impression that was where the kind of list ended. And, with a new addition to the Big East, making sure that they stay above six in terms of the number of teams in order to get an automatic qualifier, they're going to be the team to beat in that league, I think. You guys have any thoughts generally on what you heard about or thought about or read about in terms of the Pios over this past offseason?
The name Miller had come up when I was at the Landon event. Those coaches thought that Miller, they'd seen him. I think he had been at Brody Merrill's Hill Academy. They thought he was dynamite. They thought he was an unbelievable player and can do so many different things: attack, midfield, face off, shoot, pass. I think he's going to be a pretty exciting player. Denver, to me, is very interestingly poised. I think this Big East move was very good for them because I think it gets them, they still can recruit where they want out west or kind of the biggest name out there, but now they come east, and if you're looking for maybe the great athletes on offense, you get them at west. If you're looking for system guys on defense, you get them back east. And suddenly you're not going to go to Denver and disappear. And hey, if you're a Philly kid, we're going to play Villanova twice when you're here. If you're a DC kid, we're going to play Georgetown twice. I mean, I think it's a huge, huge move for Denver. And I suspect that they are on the verge of something very, very important and special.
Well, and that's probably if we're going to take a bigger picture approach at Denver, one of the things, about half of my conversation with Coach Tierney was spent about talking about classes in 2015 and 2016. The way in which he thinks this program is poised to bring in just incredible talent over the next couple seasons, melding, as you said, West Coast, Oregon, Northern California, Southern California. They've always had a stranglehold on BC. Matt Brown does incredible work in British Columbia. Obviously, Brody Merrill has kind of centralized and made recruiting out of Ontario a lot easier with the Hill Academy, and also kind of rising tide raises all ships type situation there. But then, obviously they've struggled a little bit with some of the East Coast kids that could come there, weren't able to hold on to Paul Danko after he was, pretty impressive coming out of Gilman. Same situation with Gordy Kerber this past offseason. That being said, they're in my opinion, a perennial Final Four contender that over the course of the next two seasons, if they, find replacements for this talent in the way that I think there's fair expectation that they will emerge as a perennial national championship contender. And if you are that, it makes that four-hour flight to and from the East Coast to Denver a little bit more palatable. And could be the future of the program. I don't know. We'll see.
I agree. It was funny. I was talking to someone about football recruiting and the flights are such a big deal. If you're Nebraska and you're recruiting from the south, they have to fly to Atlanta, then they fly to Omaha, then you drive an hour to Lincoln. To Denver's a direct flight. It's obviously fairly easy to do because they're going to be playing in the Big East and they're going to be making that flight quite often. So I think that Denver is clearly using its location to its advantage and certainly accentuating a lot of the positives that they have to offer. I suspect they're going to be a very, very important part of the lacrosse puzzle for the next 5 years.
And Terry, I know you were really high on Eric Law. I'm kind of curious what we see his impact, with him gone this season. I think he kind of did a lot more than maybe he got credit for nationally in terms of just running that offense.
Well, what's interesting about that offense is that because, the way in which you imagine a Canadian-style offense, it shouldn't rely as much on your traditional ex-attackman being a 50-50 scorer assist man, but yet that's the guy they've had for the last three or four seasons. So, Jack Bobsian was a transfer from Hartford, coming back home. He's a local product. Believe he went to Arapahoe.
He did. Good basketball player, too.
Yeah, and I got a chance to hang out with his brother, Logan, who was a player at Ithaca College and is now coaching at Arapahoe, and talk to him about, kind of what he thought out of his, brother's kind of capacity within Denver. And I think there's some expectation that he might be able to fill that role. Certainly, I was told that he looked good in the fall. So, a fair amount to be excited about as far as that's concerned. It's just, I guess the point that I started making is that it's surprising to me how much, a ball movement kind of pick and roll offense has produced a very traditional American quarterback over the last 4 years between Demopoulos and Law. But moving on, we're kind of keeping, I guess, as much with the theme of maybe the future pieces of the next couple of years of the national lacrosse landscape. Talk about the Ohio State Buckeyes. A team that with Dominique Alexander and Logan Schuss gone is going to have to retool a little bit, but obviously offensively with Jesse King, Turner Evans, Carter Brown, bring back plenty of tools. One of the things that I think you kind of didn't necessarily realize about Logan Schuss until he was gone is that, this guy commanded the respect of the ECAC coaches in a way that, was very difficult because they probably didn't get on TV as much and maybe weren't seen locally as much. It always made a strong impression on me, the fact that he was the ECAC Offensive Player of the Year in 2012 when, Loyola had probably three guys that were bona fide options for that award. So, not to belittle their losses, but, another team that had a few injuries in the fall. Greg Dutton didn't play. They played Carolina, didn't win. if memory serves, but I don't know a whole lot else about you know, what came out of that one. You know, Matt, I guess what did you hear coming out of Columbus?
Well, yeah, they also had Jesse King playing with Team Canada in that North Carolina scrimmage. You know, it's funny. Like, I think kind of with Logan gone, he's one of those players that was the face of that program. You know, I think if you go back and look at the headlines on Inside Lacrosse of Ohio State, how many of them have Logan Schuss in the headline? Whether that was rightfully done or not, you know, I think that remains to be seen.
I'm very excited for Ohio State. They strike me as being a team with a very definitive identity on offense, ball movement, take good shots. You know, one or two guys probably have the green light to shoot from beyond 15 yards. I think otherwise they're going to try to pound the rock inside. Defensively, they're experienced. Everyone's back. So they have, you know, you like that mix of the identity on offense, guys who buy into that system, and a defense that knows what it's doing and is pretty hungry last time around for a lot of those four-year starters. I think Ohio State's going to be pretty good.
Yeah, Bowling, Muir, Imbordino, Hawes, transfer Luke Miller from Hobart. Obviously, we mentioned Dutton, who missed the fall. How good do you think this defense can be?
Very good. And I think that they really like Luke Howard from Landon School, who didn't play much last year, but was a pretty good recruit, pretty big kid. I think they have a lot of numbers there. You know, two pretty good goalies. You know, again, inadvertently, I guess, they were down, I think, to their four-string goalie in that Carolina scrimmage. Carolina was down people, too, so it was sort of tit-for-tat on that regard. But I was very impressed talking to Coach Myers. I hadn't really spent that much time with him, but talking to him for Faceoff Yearbook, he's a sharp guy, and he's very direct, you know, and he, one of the first things he said was, well, we lost nine seniors, but all nine were all-academic Big Ten, which, you know, there's certainly, you know, whatever you think of Ohio State or what they may have done in the past lacrosse-wise, he's certainly out to change that perception or to build his own perception that they're a very bright, very hungry, very blue-collar, direct, you know, focused group of guys. I'm very excited to see them.
I guess kind of in that same vein, you know, Penn State up next. Do you have another point you wanted to make on Ohio State?
Just Gordy Kerber.
Oh,
yeah. We talked about him with
leaving Denver.
Denver and, you know, now going to Ohio State. You know, I guess you kind of get the sense, you know, I don't know as much about Ohio State as other programs, obviously. You know, it's going to be a group effort offensively. You know, not really that go-to guy for them. You know, a lot of guys just chipping in a few points here and there. It's kind of the sense I get. But, you know, what does Gordy add to that team? I'm sure you've seen him more, you know, from around this area than I have.
Well, in terms of that lefty wing shooter, you know, a guy that obviously had some familiarity with the two-man game coming from Denver, but you expect to see, you know, maybe some pass down pick downs and he can, you know, sneak over the top and get his left hand free. Or, you know, he can be on the opposite side for a skip pass if you get a two-man action with, say, you know, Jesse King and Turner Evans. One of them rolls back, you know, gets an easy 10-yard over the top, or, well, I guess 20-yard over the top pass for a 10-yard shot to Kerber. You know, that's the type of thing that you can imagine him kind of fitting easily into. In addition to, you know, potentially having some familiarity with Carter Brown, being a local guy, you know, I don't know what their club experience was like. Maybe they had some overlap there. I believe they're the same age. They're both sophomores, at least academically. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I see them being a team where, you know, their top four, five, six scorers are pretty well defined. But like a lot of teams this time of year, figuring out who's going to round out, you know, 7 through 9, which so often, you know, if your 7 through 9 is averaging 10 to 12 points, you're going to struggle to get, you know, easy wins. I think you're going to find yourself in a lot of close games. And I also think that you're probably going to find that you're not getting those types of late game goals. It seems so often to me like it's those 7 through 9 guys that aren't getting the defense's attention that are able to get goals late in games when the defense ups their pressure.
It's and Adamson at Denver.
Yeah, exactly.
And
yeah.
That's one of the things that would worry me about Denver last year, and I think Coach Tierney talked about it, was that they kind of ran that first midfield into the ground, and those guys did so many other things, but they didn't have a great second midfield. And I think that this year, and they play such a tough schedule, and I think that this year they do have a second midfield. I think they've emphasized depth at midfield, and I think they've emphasized having attackmen who can also play midfield if they need to, and I think that they will be much better deeper into the season than they have been in the past.
Well, and Matt, one of the things that you said about Ohio State that I think extends to Penn State as well is a little bit of a team effort, and I think the negative way to look at that is like almost facelessness in a way that, do you really even know, you know, what this team looks like, who these guys look like, who they are, etc. And Penn State strikes me as a team, and this is kind of in a Jeff Tambroni type of way, that I think is in their last phases of not having stars, yet still being a very good team. You know what I mean? Like, I remember this following Cornell through the 04, 05, 06, when, you know, Joe Beloukas was kind of emerging, basically before Max Seabold emerged as a star and John Glynn was there right alongside him. But, you know, Dave Mitchell and who was the
Sean Greenhall?
Yeah. You know, these guys that were people were relatively unfamiliar with until they had these breakout seasons as you know, juniors and seniors at Cornell. And I think that that's kind of what we're dealing with a little bit here. Last season, this season in particular, TJ Sanders is a guy that had a, you know, 50-point freshman year. So he will emerge as that guy as long as he can continue along a positive trajectory. And I say this with the entire exception of Austin Kout, who, you know, is going to compete as, you know, top save percentage goalie with the, you know, long hair. It's pretty recognizable, et cetera. But, you know, what are your thoughts? What are your guys' thoughts on Penn State in terms of, you know, where they are in the Jeff Tamburini era? You know, one important note for those of you that are unaware, you know, they got a little bit of a butt end of the ribs from the CAA in terms of their eligibility for the CAA tournament in their final year before joining the Big Ten as a full member. Big Ten lacrosse starts in earnest in 2015. Essentially it means that if they want to get to the NCAA tournament, they're going to have to qualify as an at-large. I guess I'm just interested in both of your thoughts on that opinion of this is kind of the end of one era of Penn State lacrosse in which they are very good, but they are not a star-driven team.
The two things, I saw them twice and talked to Jeff and talked to a lot of the other coaches about them. Things that caught my eye, like individually on offense, Sturgis is quick, Sanders is a very good finisher, Ahern seems like a very good kind of passer-shooter type. None of them really super jumped out at me on offense, Sturgis probably the most. The midfield's okay. I think that they really are looking for a little bit more out of the midfield. But their defense, they have three long stick middies who could play for anyone. And their burn side, especially on close defense, is fantastic. And one of the things about Kout that really impressed me was talking to Jeff Tamburini after having seen them at the Landon tournament in both their scrimmages. And he said Kout works very, very hard at limiting his movement. You know, Tamburini, you play goalie, and how often you hear the coach say, if we get the goalie moving. And this was a kid who came in as a freshman and was dynamite. He was terrific, but he would tend to bait players. He probably could have done that all 4 years and been fine, but I'm just astonished at how hard he has worked to refine what was already a very good game, and the fact that he moves so little. You know, he's just his energy's on the shooters, and he gets a scouting report, and he watches film, but he just does everything. And I think everyone on that team feeds off that, and their defense is very, very good, and their long stick middies are terrific. And so, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, the goalie's a 9.999. Close defense is probably an 8.5. Long stick middies are probably a 10. Offensive midfield is probably 5, and attack is probably an 8. But across the board, except for that midfield, if they get that midfield depth, and Ponte, the freshman from Islip, is a good player, and Dan Craig, a freshman from Canada, looked a very good player before he got hurt in those two scrimmages, I think they could be a really, really good team.
And Terry, I think that was interesting that you brought up about, you know, them being a faceless program. We put them on the cover of the magazine last year, and I think we had like 25 guys on the cover of the magazine. You know, they're not, you know, use Cornell with Rob Pinnell as the prime example of a program that is based around its star player in terms of, you know, the media exposure and who is the face of the program. You know, I love Tom LaCrosse, though, as a midfielder, and he kind of has that mentality, you know, it's kind of the mentality that Tamburini has and the team has of this faceless nature. You know, he's just a tough...
Well, you mean because his name is literally as generic as it can get?
He was bred to be a lacrosse player. He's hard-nosed, he's tough. You know, I saw them against Villanova last year, and, you know, he took some brutal hits, you know, and he's a guy who gets back up, and, you know, I think Tamburini said something after the game that, yeah, sometimes he has to tell him to take it back a step so he doesn't kill himself out there. You know, that's kind of this mentality of the team that I see. And the midfield was a problem last year, and, you know, I think, as you said, Christian, you know, it's certainly not the strength of this team this year. But, you know, given the nature of this team, maybe there is a kind of a nameless, faceless guy in that midfield who will emerge.
Moving on to Johns Hopkins Blue Jays, another team destined for Big Ten lacrosse. Obviously, big news in June. Their addition essentially created the reality of the league in general as they became an affiliate sixth member to go along with Ohio State, Penn State, who we just discussed, Michigan, Rutgers, and Maryland, who Rutgers and Maryland will be joining as full members going forward. When I got back from being out of the country I had heard all about this Hopkins reinvention offensively. What is this? What's going on here?
From what I understand, a buddy who's a coach was at their fall scrimmages. They were at the same time as the Landon scrimmages, so I couldn't attend both. But from what I understand, it's a lot of sort of pick and roll, ball movement, looking for three on twos. Stanwyck is going to have the ball a lot at X. You know, I think there was some question about whether Rob Guida would play attack or midfield. It sounds like he's going to stay on midfield. Ryan Brown will be on attack. Obviously, Brandon Benn will be on attack. But it sounds like they're just trying to spice it up a little bit, go a little bit more up-tempo. You know, maybe that's something they should have looked into a little sooner. And frankly, I'm curious, again, you know, third quarter of the game against Virginia in Charlottesville, and they give up three goals, and now they're down two. Like, are they still going to run? Are they still going to do that stuff, knowing that you're going to also give, you know, you may score more, but you're going to have more turnovers too. And I don't, the turnover part of it has never, or the up-tempo part of it has never been their identity or their style, and I'm curious how they sort of adapt to that and whether they stick with it or they say, you know what, we've been pretty good doing what we usually do in the past. You know, maybe we'll revert back to that toward late in the season. I think they have good IQ players. I think Stanwyck, you know, I don't think they have great athletes, but they have very good IQ players. I think Ryan Brown's a terrific shooter. I think Ben's a terrific shooter. Stanwyck's tougher than I thought he was, having seen him take some shots last year and get right back up, almost like you're saying about Tommy Lacrosse. Midfield, Guida's a great shooter. Connor Reed, I think, is a pretty good athlete, very good passer. So, you know, they have some stuff there. They like their defense. They like their goalies. So we'll see. But the offense, to answer your question, from what I understand, it's just sort of a lot of pick and roll kind of movement, three on two type stuff.
Well, and it's interesting to me because one of the things that, you know, is kind of stems from that is, you know, in 05, 06, 07, 08, basically, you know, I guess it probably actually goes back even farther from, you know, Adam Doniger in 03 through, you know, Paul Rabel, Stephen Pizer's graduation in 08. You know, this was a team that really generated a lot of offense based on long midfield dodges from up top that were going down the alleys. They were good at making defenses slide. And I think that maybe one of the things, you know, it's a little bit of a chicken or the egg type situation. Has that become less effective because those players haven't been in the program? Or is it that defenses have focused on learning how to adjust and recover better to those alley dodges, and as a result, you know, the offenses that have become more efficient over the last 3 to 4 seasons have been offenses that result, you know, that revolved a lot more around two-man games, slip picks, you know, nice passes on screens, stuff like that. And if that's the case, if the latter is the case, then maybe the former is the reason why they were able to do it this offseason. You know, you graduate John Rannigan and John Greeley, two guys that were touted to be the next iteration of those big alley-dodging, long-dodging midfielders. It's almost akin to, you know, I make a big deal out of how the Denver Broncos got so much benefit out of trading for Peyton Manning, not just because they received the services of Peyton Manning, but allowed them to get out from under having to have Tim Tebow on their team, who was so popular but ultimately wasn't a part of their long-term plan. Well, I think that you can make a similar argument for the graduation of Rannigan and Greeley and the way it might open up their offense to this type of skill set. The thing that's so interesting to me about that is that, to me, the most iconic play of the Rannigan-Greeley combination when those guys were at their best together were those flips and fake flips mm-hmm. that they scored a handful of goals off of, particularly when Greeley would carry right-handed from down top and Rannigan would sweep over top to him and catch the feed left-handed. I thought that worked so well, and it's, you know, it's not the same thing as what you're talking about, but, you know, it is similar in some regard. And, you know, one of the last points I want to make on this is, you know, moving Ryan Brown from midfield to attack, to me, you know, I guess I wonder, it's akin to what my reaction was to Albany moving Lyle Thompson from midfield to attack last year. And I realize that those two guys are going to be asked to do very different things at the attack. But what do you lose in terms of creativity and offensive prowess from the midfield that will be gained at the attack? Obviously, it worked out for Albany, so I suppose I should give Hopkins the benefit of the doubt. But I just thought Ryan Brown was the most creative offensive player from the midfield for Johns Hopkins last season. I think Rob Greta's return, you know, he could fill that role in a way that, you know, it could be a neutral. But then the question is, how do you get better? Who else emerges?
And remember, Ryan Brown was a point man and extra man, too.
Right.
So for a midi, that's, I think, unusual. I don't know. I think they've... players. I mean,
yeah.
I talked to a coach who went to one of their Hopkins practices last year, and he texted said they have so many middies that we don't, you know, Holden Cotone and Bronson Kelly, all these guys, Connor Reed, you know, all these guys looked pretty good to me. And I do think their short safety middies are going to be pretty good. You know, they really like Carlini, the freshman from Philly. Castronova's back, or expected back. I don't think he played in the fall, but he could have if they needed him to. So, you know, the close defense should be fine. They love Fields. Second time I'm going to mention Bullis in this podcast, but Fields from Bullis is a terrific player, and they have more than enough goalies. Jeez, right. I mean, they have the kid from who started at Providence as a freshman transferred there. And so, you know, I mean, I think they'll be good. I don't think they'll be great, but certainly with the recruiting class they have coming in, I think this year could potentially be better than I think they're going to be.
And I think, you know, Jeff Shannon would probably be the best guy to kind of give us the insight on this, but their recruiting class is coming in, and even, you know, their underclassmen as opposed to their upperclassmen, you know, he noted that there's a stark difference in how well they're executing this new offense, just because of, you know, the guys, like, they don't have the big, you know, alley-dodging midfielders, like you mentioned, in, you know, these younger classes, and, you know, they're kind of getting a little bit better of a grasp, you know, because they're the type of player who should be playing in this kind of high IQ system that they're implementing.
Yeah, well, and Christian, you mentioned the two other things that I wanted to talk about when it comes to this team. One thing I quickly want to mention, Michael Pellegrino has, for the last two seasons, been my favorite Hawkins player because of his motor and his toughness, and I think that, you know, as he becomes an upperclassman, one would presume that that motor and toughness becomes more a part of the overall identity of the team, and that what he brings on a day-to-day basis as an upperclassman permeates throughout the rest of the program. And I believe he's a captain.
I think he is as a junior.
But you mentioned Phil Castronova, who, you know, to me, how dangerous they are in transition is almost entirely dependent on whether or not Castronova can play. And over the last three seasons, you know, that's been my experience in watching this team play. You know, he's another guy whose game I've liked for a long time. And, you know, ACL, then an Achilles, it's one of those situations where you just, you know, it's such a punch in the gut for a kid that, you know, has worked pretty hard in order to maintain his body and be right, and obviously that's a huge part of his game. But I think that, you know, one of the things that's even more significant to what he does, what he brings to them in transition, is just a willingness to not be afraid of getting yelled at for having taken a bad shot when he comes off the field. And I think that's an attitude that, you know, the team probably as a whole needs to carry a little bit better. And I think, you know, Coach Petromala and Coach Benson, Coach Dwan all understand that on the surface you want your players to obey you. But you also understand that a big part of playmaking is knowing that they're going to disobey you. And I think Castronova, over the last couple seasons, was the best example of that.
And Pellegrino, too. The other guy you mentioned, he tends to make mistakes, but they keep playing him because his upside is so much better than his downside. I think he makes mistakes that, frankly, the other guys don't make, but he also makes plays the other guys don't make. And maybe that's a good sign that they will bite their tongues and let the offense figure itself out if they, you know, have a few turnovers in a row in one of their big games.
Well, and not every mistake is created equal. You know, there's a big difference between throwing the ball away on a fast break versus, you know, going for a reckless over-the-head check when you're up one with a minute to go. You know, and I think Pellegrino is more likely to make the former than the latter. You know, he knows that there are some times when he just needs to stay in front of his man and push him down the alley and make him pass it on to the next guy. And I think that those are the types of things that you know, this Hopkins team in general, you know, maybe has been lacking a little bit in some instances. But again, you know, they're another team that was, they weren't that far away.
No, not, well, 9-5, but beat Maryland when they were ranked number one, beat Virginia.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
Beat Carolina 2 years ago. Yeah. You know, I mean, there's definitely talent there. And the last thing I wanted to talk about is that, you know, we talked about goalies as it related to Notre Dame on the last podcast, and you already mentioned Jack Connolly, I believe is his name,
yes,
the transfer from Providence. It seems to me, and you know, I'm curious, you talked to the coaching staff, but it seemed to me from what I read that A. Schneider was probably, if they were starting a game, A. Schneider would have been the starting goalie if they were playing in the fall?
I think so. I think that was what I understood too, yes.
And the thing that's most unique about that to me is that the last time a Hopkins starter started his first game as the upperclassman, I mean, I think it was Scott Smith in 05 when he was a transfer from Carolina. You know, because everybody else, you know, Jesse, I believe, was a sophomore that year, and he started for, you know, he ended up starting that year and started for three seasons. And then Gavazdin started right away, correct? And then Bassett took over from Gavazdin. Gavazdin's senior year, Pierce's freshman year. So, and that's not to say Schneider has started, I believe, two or three games over the course of his career because of suspension and stuff like that, but I'm referring more to as a full-time starter. I've always liked his game, and I'd be really excited to see this happened for him, but I also think it would be interesting for a Hopkins program that doesn't seem to like to make an investment in a 1 or 2 year goalie.
Well, and Connolly was interesting because he's a lefty, and I, of course, had not figured this out, but Coach Petromala had, and he said, well, we lost four of our five losses last year were to lefty goalies. So at the very least, Conley gives us a look that, you know, gave us some problems last year. I thought, oh, that's why he's the coach at Hopkins, because he figures out stuff like that. And I think they have a freshman from Syosset, whose name is escaping me at the moment, a goalie who's quite good. I think he was a four-year starter at Syosset, so he's seen a high level of lacrosse. I think they'll be pretty good in goal.
Well, let's move on from, you know, maybe the most tradition-rich program in college lacrosse to a team that, because, you know, they're relatively young in terms of a program, is trying to make a pretty strong tradition for itself this year. I believe they'll be going for their first NCAA tournament berth. And getting back to the Big East, that's St. John's as the Red Storm. Bring back, you know, Matt, one of our conversations that we've had in our editorial meetings throughout the course of this season is that with the exception of Lyle Thompson, who for a lot of reasons is a unique star in the sport, the beginning of the 2014 season will present a less star-filled lineup. For example, the preseason All-American teams are going to have more unfamiliar names, or at least less familiar names, than usual. Kira McArdle, premier attackman for St. John's, flanked by two very good and not-to-be-overlooked attackmen, Kevin Cernuto and Colin Keegan. But McArdle is probably among the biggest stars. It's remarkable, and it's not to be undersold, how significant that is to me when it comes to the St. John's Red Storm have one of the biggest stars in college lacrosse.
And every coach in the Big East, if you ask about, you know, what are your thoughts on the league, he will be one of the first three things that comes out of their mouth. You know, from the standpoint of maybe the fan, he might not be the most well-known guy, but he certainly is well-known amongst all the coaches in the league. It's interesting that, you know, like you said, just the lack of star power. We've been dominated by so many heavy personalities in the sport for, you know, the past at least 4 years, you know, in terms of, you know, we had the Pinnell and the Stanwyck and kind of guys who, when just their face and their name alone kind of carried these teams and kind of carried things. You know, it's just an interesting year, but, you know, I think McArdle is certainly first-team All-American talent, and, you know, him along with Alex Lovett-Hobart and, you know, you mentioned Lyle Thompson already. You know, the biggest stars in this game are not from Johns Hopkins or Maryland or Virginia. You know, they're from St. John's, they're from Hobart, they're from Albany. You know, it's just a different face of the sport here.
I love that that attack has played together for so long. And I mean, I was fortunate enough to talk to Jason Miller, the St. John's coach, for Face Off Yearbook. And the minute we hung up, I texted my friend at Georgetown. I said, when do you play St. John's? Because I want to make sure I have that day off from work so I can go, because I'm very excited to see them. And obviously, they have more than just that attack. And I think they even have a fourth attack, one whom they like very much, a junior, who would probably maybe be the guy next year. But, you know, Coach Miller came from UMass, and those UMass teams were well known for up-tempo, but being very blue-collar and very in-your-face and chip on the shoulder, and I see a lot of that from St. John's. I saw them 2 years ago when they beat Georgetown in overtime. The attack is terrific, but, you know, they have a good mentality about them, a good midfield. Fitzgerald, number three, is a pretty good shooter. So, you know, I think they're going to be a lot of fun to watch this year, and it goes to the depth of the game. You know, here we are talking about St. John's, and if they're on TV, please watch them, because they are really fun to watch.
I think McArdle started, like, maybe all but one game in his career, you know.
He's been around for a while. There's no question about it.
He was starting too. So, like you said, these guys playing together so long. You know, is this their year to make this run in this conference?
Well, that was the last thing I wanted to touch on when it came to St. John's, and that is that, you know, I remember they had a good season, I believe, 3 years ago, or they, you know, had a good early start. There was a stretch where we were kind of, you know, paying close attention to them. You know, and the oldest, the Napoli brother, I believe, was a long pole that was causing, you know, mm-hmm. he was taking face-offs, causing like three turnovers a game, you know, whatever, and then he graduated, and then, you know, there's the next guy up, and it was, I think, you know, last year, Dylan Ayers was a really good example of you know, kind of fitting into the next mold of that legacy. They graduate Jeff Lohman, you know, but Lohman had a couple of injury issues last year, and his replacement filled in nicely. It seems like, and this is the difference between a good team and a good program, you know, what Coach Miller and you know, you mentioned having an opportunity to talk to him. I've gotten to interview him a handful of times as well over the course of the last couple seasons, and, you know, you can see the positive momentum building around this team, this program, and, you know, it hasn't been easy. You can tell that, you know, he's taking a hammer to a boulder in trying to create, you know, the statue of the team that, you know, he thinks is deserving of this athletic department.
And the one thing, too, that says a lot about St. John's is that they were one of the few Big East teams, if not the only Big East team, that was able to keep Syracuse on the schedule. They're playing this year, I think, down in Atlanta, like a neutral site game. But that says a lot to St. John's, too, and certainly what Coach Dusko sees of that program, like that they're able to keep that game is big for them and big for their SOS.
And just think if Lohman doesn't get hurt and have to leave that Georgetown game at halftime, you know, could we be looking at them as an NCAA tournament team winning that Big East tournament? They were that close. It was two losses in a row, that and the Villanova game the week after that.
And they were close. Remember, reaching the Big East final 2 years ago.
Yeah. So they're knocking on the door. That's, it's just a matter of do they actually knock the door down or, kind of continue in this middle of the pack there.
Well, and not to, kind of break the mold of the way that we're talking about this now, but, I have Villanova and Georgetown, the next two teams on this list, and, depending on how the season breaks, you can see either of them, maybe emerging as a Big East favorite heading into the tournament or missing the tournament altogether. Both these teams, I think, have talent that could go that direction, but also holes that give you pause as they enter this year. Starting with Villanova, John Clue is... kind of one of those guys that you talked about. He's a 5'4" midfielder, the type of guy that you don't necessarily expect to be as productive as he was as a freshman in 2013. But because of Villanova's unique offensive identity, you can kind of imagine him. It's a style of play that requires less winning your matchup to get your hands free and more understanding how to win your matchup before you have the ball. And I think that he, not to say that he doesn't have moves when he has the ball on his stick, but he knows what my sense is, and I have never talked to him about this, and I don't know if I've ever talked to him at all, but my sense is that, he, based on how that offense moves, knows what he's going to do before he gets the ball, and then he's really good at executing it, really good at keeping his stick away from checks, hold on to his composure, and, maintaining his balance when he gets the ball and finishing. And I think that that's, emblematic of what we've seen of a lot of guys that have come through this offense in the last couple seasons. Kevin Cunningham probably being the most notable. They lose Jack Rice, who was probably the most surprising inclusion in the U.S. national team tryouts, but still comported himself very well, showed himself to be among, the premier American finishers, even though he is no longer a part of the process. Is that right?
Right, he did not make the
cut-down
roster.
So, still, and then John Locasio.
He's the one I was going to mention.
Yeah, the long-stick midi. So he's a senior, correct?
Yes.
Right? Yeah, so he's kind of, taken on the mantle that Jesse Bernhardt and Sky Ratliff left behind in terms of, the premier Division I long-stick midi. But, Locasio was a part of that U.S. team tryout as well. So, two real high-end talents for Villanova this year. I don't have a question. You guys can just talk.
I mean, they're a fascinating team, and just for a lot of the reasons that you hit on, they don't necessarily have the star power, but their offense is unique, and as we see it, in some ways being emulated by teams like Johns Hopkins, and they get the personnel that can run it. They get smart kids. You talk about John Clue; he's in their prestigious business school, going for a really kind of advanced business degree, and when I went to practice, he actually wasn't there because he was taking an exam that all the business school guys have to take. So they're smart players. They may not be physically imposing, but they don't need to be physically imposing. Devin McNamara is a freshman from Loyola who has been absolutely impressive this fall in practice. Things were running through him. They have some injury concerns. Jack Curran, Tim Mulrin, two starting attackmen who, for various reasons, weren't playing in the fall because of injury. Not exactly sure the severity of that going forward. But, they get smart guys. They get guys who don't go to other places because, like you said, in the case of John Clue, he's 5'4", is a big-name program, and I'm using that term in the traditional sense, going to go after him. Probably not. And then, as you said with Locasio, there may not be, more of a player in the league who has an impact on all ends of the field as he does. When I was at practice, they had him actually on extra man offense. They had him on man down defense.
With a long pole or with a short stick?
With a long pole.
Wow.
Taking shots from outside. And, he can play in the wing. He can play close. He can do everything. There's not really a player in the league that is as good at everything as he is.
And they give him that freedom. You know, the whole Mount Carolinas was the same way. You're up there and you're disrupting so many things, and you make it so hard for the team to even clear and then get into their offense. And Locascio, I mean, I think he'll play more close along committee, but he can go wherever they need him to go. He's a very versatile guy. What I was asking one of the opposing coaches about Clue, and I said, well, what is he going to see this year that he didn't see last year? And said, well, he's going to get a pull. But don't forget, I mean, they played Georgetown twice. First time Georgetown shorted him. He had a big game, Villanova won. Second time Georgetown, I think, pulled him in the Big East tournament, and Villanova still won. You know, I mean, so I think we've seen a little bit already of how teams are going to adjust to Clue, and I think he's going to, you know, knock wood if he's healthy. I think he's going to be fine.
And it is fascinating, you know, when I was at their practice to watch them practice and you know, the way that Simon Connor, their offensive coordinator, kind of runs the practice. He stays kind of above everybody and is really, really harping on their spacing more than anything, you know, more than any other coach that I've seen. You know, he doesn't necessarily even look at, you know, where the ball is. He's looking at their feet and seeing where they're spacing, and he's stopping them and making sure that they're spread out the right way. It's just a fascinating offense to look at.
And they take good shots, as you said earlier. You know, a lot of guys who played attack in high school, so they're used to seeing some different things, or they're used to, you know, oh my gosh, I'm being defended by a short stick, you know, and that's what if Clue gets a long stick. Now you have a guy who played attack in high school who's been defended by a short stick. You know, they're very good at taking what the defense gives them.
In Georgetown, you know, not, as I said, duality in terms of the directions you can reasonably expect their seasons to go. Probably not as likely that they have, you know, a Big East championship quality season as it is for Villanova. That being said, you know, there are some pieces here. And Christian, you know, I guess, look, I want to start a little bit more about what they need and didn't have last year and really haven't had in a long time. And for Kevin Warren, you can tell how important it's been to his successful teams. So here's a guy who had a really good relationship with Nico Amato when he was at Maryland. You know, and obviously Amato, what he was able to do in his first two seasons as a starter, as a Terp, is really well documented. Comes to Georgetown, and, you know, for what seems like the 10th consecutive year, they struggle to get consistent goalie play. They get about 49% as a team. Do you see a solution to their goalie question currently?
Possibly. Haley looks like a pretty good player. He's a very good athlete. They did not have a goalie in this. They don't have a goalie in the freshman class. And Alex Joyce did not practice when I was there, who started last year early in the season, you know, had some injury issues and didn't play the second half of the year, was not on the roster, or was on the roster in the fall, but didn't practice when I was there. And I think his status is a little bit up in the air. I do think that goalie is going to be an emphasis of theirs going forward, especially given that we don't know the status of Joyce for the season. You know, they'll be better. There's certainly, no one's working harder than those guys. No one's recruiting harder than those guys. I think they've landed a few home runs for the, you know, recruits down the
14,
line coming
15,
in. 16 exactly.
From high school.
Exactly. And, you know, to me, he made a big statement, Kevin Warren made a big statement about the program's culture when that Syracuse game, you know, the final home game last year, and I think he started with like seven guys in the field because he'd had something he didn't like, some violation of team rules, and it was enough guys who has violated that team rule that he started Syracuse game with seven guys in the field and whatever it was. So I feel like at the very least, like, he's building that foundation. You know, when you buy a house, what do they tell you? Get a good foundation, get a good roof, get a good windows. And Warren is building the foundation. He's building the roof. He's going to get the windows. Like, they're going to be fine. They're going to be fine. And people just need to be patient with them. I suspect, as you suspect, that this year the Big East is probably not in their reach. They might be. I might be wrong, but I think that certainly going forward, they're going to be a pretty impressive program.
Matt, when you came back from their practice, their fall practice in 2012, one of the things that stands out in my memory from the way that you described that practice to me is that it was as physical as you had ever seen. Right? That's accurate?
Yeah, absolutely. And we're talking about last year, 2012. I mean, he was testing his guys in terms of physicality and having them go after each other.
And you said that wasn't to the degree this year.
No, I think they're going to be able to rely more on just being athletic than having to be punch you in the mouth physical this year. You know, last year I think they were kind of using that physicality. You know, obviously Warren wanted to send a message to his players, as Christian alluded to, but I think he knew also just on the field that was one edge that he could have that maybe this year doesn't need to rely on nearly as much. Interesting thing also was, you know, Warren was talking about, you know, all his players came back in great shape. They were, you know, they didn't come back, you know, all gassed when they were doing drills and stuff like that. So he rewarded them by having lifting sessions at 7 a.m.
Instead of 6 a.m.
So I think that kind of speaks to how he runs practice. You know, it's always going to be physical. He's always going to be, and I don't say tough on his players, and I don't mean that necessarily in a negative way. I just mean that he runs a tough practice. He expects a lot out of them. But now that they have kind of some more talent and some more athleticism, I don't think they need to rely on that as a crutch.
And I love Tyler Nahr, the long stick midi. He's a face-off guy. He's terrific. And in the fall, you know, he's a super bright kid, and he's a very good at face-offs. And I mean, I think he's going to give them, you know, a lot of sort of make-it-take-it type games. Or if they fall behind by a couple goals, you know, he's certainly a guy where you would say, okay, well, we're probably not going to give up those three-goal runs because he's going to win. You know, he's not going to lose three or four straight face-offs.
Well, and that was the point that I was going to make. So, you know, in Nahr, who has had as, you know, rough a injury luck or history as Phil Castronova, who we mentioned earlier in this podcast, you know, he was at 62% as a face-off guy last year. You know, he does play... He plays defense as well. He's not a long stick Fogo, you know. And he's a star. He's the type of guy that for a 6-9 team probably didn't get nearly the shine that he deserved. And I think they have another one of those guys offensively in Riley O'Connor, their other captain. Both of those guys are captains this year, who put up 56 points and shot 36% last year. And again, for a 6-9 team, maybe that doesn't get noticed nearly the degree as it would if he were on a 9-6 team. And you know, when you look at personal accolades, maybe that's not the only thing that you should kind of evaluate or analyze.
He's a great passer. McCormick is a very good shooter, too, a very good outside shooter, Charlie McCormick. I think he's a junior this year. Devin Lewis, a freshman from Jacksonville, they really like and passes the eyeball test. I mean, at least they have numbers. Remember last year, and even forget the Syracuse game for a minute, but last year, I mean, I think they were dressing 34 guys sometimes or even less, 24 sometimes. You know, they just didn't have all that many guys. And this year, at least they have numbers, at least they have players, and they can have full field practices and things like that. They'll get better.
And you know, there's definitely some young talent there. Peter Conley, I think he's ranked in our top 100. I think he's on the latter half of our top 100 rankings. You know, he looked great in practice. When I was at practice, there was, I don't know who it was, but there was an upperclassman getting water, you know, talking to just one of the other guys on the team. And this was probably only their first week of practice, so it was just a few days in. And he commented, hey, these freshmen are really good. You know, once they get some meat on their bones, they're going to be really talented players.
And they weren't that great in the fall, to be fair. Not the freshmen, Georgetown on the whole. I saw them against Loyola, and it wasn't their finest hour. But, you know, I think they'll be fine.
Yeah.
And the last team I wanted to hit on in this podcast is neither a Big East nor Big Ten team, although there was, you know, questions as to whether or not they might potentially land in either conference. Right now, they're conference-less. If I had to make a bet, Air Force ends up in the Atlantic Sun, at least on a temporary basis going forward. But ultimately, the conference realignment and shuffling was not beneficial for the Falcons. But I wanted to make sure that we were able to include them in the podcast, not only because got an opportunity to see them play, but certainly, you know, in a very sad way, they had one of the more significant fall seasons, I guess, for lack of a better way of putting it, of any team in Division I. And I want to start with what I saw when I got an opportunity to see them play against Notre Dame. And, you know, that was an offense, top six, that they looked like incredibly confident automatons. All six kind of look like each other. They're between 5'11 and 6'2, between 170 and 185 pounds, you know, with the exception of Eric Smith, excuse me, who's a little bit shorter than that, but you know, Crampton, Dreyer, you know, the list goes on. Their top six offensively was very, very good, and you know, you could tell when they played Notre Dame, it was about being decisive with the ball, making you know, good routine passes, and finding yourself in a position where you're going to be able to make a good shot. And it was very impressive to see. They got good goalie play. I expect Air Force, and I've expected Air Force to be good for a couple of seasons now, and I expect, you know, 2014, they have an opportunity in a five-team ECAC to compete for a league, you know, certainly a spot in a league tournament, and then potentially, who knows, against Ohio State and Fairfield primarily, with Michigan and Bellarmine rounding out the conference as well. But then in addition to that, you know, certainly you know, very, very sad news coming out of Colorado Springs is when the team was supposed to be playing at the Play for Parkinson's event in Northern Virginia, an event they participated in last year. Tragically, Eric Saramet, in a car with his family, was in a one car accident in which the car rolled, and his wife, you know, sadly died in the accident. And I had an opportunity to talk to Coach Saramet after the scrimmage, and he's a guy that I've gotten to know a little bit over the course of last year, and have really enjoyed my conversations with him, and you know, really, really have a lot of respect for you know, the way in which he both, I guess the best way to put it is handle his emotions, and I don't mean that to say that he, you know, pushed them down and didn't let other people realize that it wasn't an easy circumstance for him. You know, watching his post-game conversation with Kevin Corrigan when they went through the handshake line, you could tell, you know, that he understood that this wasn't going to be an easy thing for him. And I think that, you know, that's not, it strikes me that it would be easier to just try to put on a stoic face and pretend like nothing happened. And he didn't do that. And I think it was a really fine example for his players who will go on to military service, in which the likelihood that they'll encounter, you know, similar types of loss is pretty high. And I think that's an important example to set. And I wanted to, you know, just kind of end this this part two of the Fall Look Back podcast, you know, both kind of expressing, you know, profound sadness as well as, you know, really significant amount of respect for, you know, what he was able to show and do for the Air Force program.
Well said. Absolutely.
Well, that'll do it for part two of the Inside the Cross Fall podcast. We appreciate you listening to us. Make sure you come back and check out the final portion of the podcast the next time we get it posted.
Inside the Cross podcast.